Hi, Bill Smaldone. Welcome again to KABU.
Hi, Bill.
Bill Smaldone teaches history at Willamette University in Salem. His specialty is Germany in the 20th century. Writes a lot, including books, one confronting Hitler, another called European Socialism. He's put in much work studying the failure of the German Revolution. After World War I, a pivotal point in world history, Bill served 4 years as a radical on the Salem City Council. He co-founded the radio station, KMUZ, like KABU, out of Salem. And he's on the board of the Salem Weekly, a radical, kind of countercultural city paper. Bill, last week we discussed Hitler's rise to absolute power by manufacturing a crisis and the central act of it was burning of the Reichstag, Germany's parliament building, symbol of democracy. And Hitler blamed the communists for doing it and sort of succeeded in terms of the German population and then rounded up the communists and the whole left. And after several months, he finally got the parliament, sitting in another building, of course. It voted to give him emergency powers to unilaterally act, and then the story went on to its horrible end. We also discussed how Hitler maneuvered to take control of the military. You really can't be Hitler without control of the men with guns. That was Germany 84 years ago. Today, the U.S., it's a very different society, to be sure, but in unnerving ways now, as Sinclair Lewis's 1930s book title reads, it could happen here. Still, this country's not Germany in the 30s. So, Bill, I thought we could compare Germany in the 30s, the U.S. today, on a few big issues that have to do with the road to fascism or to totalitarian government, and of what kind might be characterized as society. The first issue, of course, is the overall economy and state of working people. The second will be about whether the right wing can manufacture a crisis that would allow them to gain near absolute power. And that has to do with the judiciary and police and popular commitment to democracy. And finally, what should the left be doing in this threatening period? All in 24 minutes. So talk fast. So tell us about the economy of Germany at that period and the state of working people and the kinds of conflicts that were occurring.
Sure. Well, the situation in Germany in 1932, so the year before Adolf Hitler was appointed to the chancellorship, was catastrophic. Germany had the highest unemployment rate among any advanced industrial country, about 40%.
This was in the Great Depression, the Great World Depression.
And correct. That's correct.
It was in worse shape than any other country, right?
It was in terrible shape, and the conservative government that dominated the scene between 1929 and 1933 had implemented severe austerity programs that they thought would right the capitalist ship. And all they did was deepen the depression and reduce the social benefits that were due to unemployed workers. And so by 1932, you had many millions of people who were long-time unemployed, who no longer qualified for very much, if any, social benefits, and were underwater and desperate, literally starving. So people were casting about, right, for any political movement that could help them. And the problem for the Social Democrats was that they were identified with the Republic, which was in crisis and was therefore delegitimized. The communists were seen by many Germans as instruments of Moscow. They were increasingly attractive to unemployed workers. So the Communist Party was growing in the early 1930s, mainly through the attraction of the unemployed, but so was the Nazi Party. And in fact, the Nazi Party was growing much faster, and the Nazi Party was growing in a manner that drew on all social classes. The Nazis were the first German political movement to become a true people's party and win people from every sector. So by the summer of 1932 in the parliamentary elections, the German Social Democrats were getting about 20%, the communists were getting about 13%, and the Nazis were getting 37%. And the rest of the vote was spread among a group of middle-of-the-road bourgeois parties, some of which were monarchists, some of which were more moderate. But the middle classes were increasingly drawn to the right. So it was a catastrophic situation in which the forces of the left were in retreat. Talk of a general strike usually led to the conclusion that this would be impossible in depression conditions because the labor movement had the market working against it. People were so desperate that to get them to go on strike was very difficult, and there were lots of scabs to take away your job, so people were uninterested in that. So the left was fighting from a position of weakness.
Today, of course, the left is also fighting for a somewhat better position, but also of weakness. And the working class is nowhere near in a position, I mean, the great mass of people are nowhere near a position that Germany was in the 30s. On the other hand, there's very high inequality, huge resentment, lots of people moving down, their kids can't get decent jobs.
Right.
And there are worrying signs, right, of economic instability, the financial system. They're ripping off everything now, and the whole thing could fall apart again.
That's right. I think it's very true that conditions in the United States aren't nearly as bad as they were in Germany in 1932. Say we have unemployment of, you know, around 5%. That's, by historical standards, not too bad. And we have a stock market that's going up. We have an economy that is very strong in some sectors, is exporting a lot of stuff. Consumption levels for many people are quite high. On the other hand, we have long-term, widespread, downward social mobility for many people who come from parts of the population that for a long time expected their standards of living to continue to rise, even though they were not doing skilled work. Many people were working in different sectors of production in which you didn't need a college degree to get a job. And for a long time, they expected that those jobs would continue to exist and they would continue to share in the overall wealth that was being generated. That, of course, was reversed beginning about 40 years ago, especially after Ronald Reagan came to power, when the capitalists launched a sort of counteroffensive against the labor movement and the Republicans led the neoliberal charge. The Democrats then sort of got on board with them, and as a result, both of the mainstream parties were delegitimized in the minds of many workers in this country who felt like they had nowhere to go when they looked around for a political party that would defend their interests. That's why, in my view, many people have supported Donald Trump in the last election, although I don't think one should claim that the workers are primarily responsible for his victory, because the swing in the working class vote was not that large. There was some increase for the right as opposed to the last election for Obama, but it wasn't that large. In fact, most of Trump's constituency came from people who were rather better off.
Basically, working people are angry and resentful and don't know what to do, which is similar to Germany. But then there's a lot of people who are not in that position. On the other hand, with an economic crisis and maybe some kind of terrible climate failure and spiking of food prices, you could see an enormous number of very angry and frightened and precarious people. I mean, that's another point, right? That it's not just that they're downwardly mobile. Most everybody in this country is a heartbeat away from destitution, unless you have a family who'll help you out.
That's true. I think I just heard recently that something like 45% of adults in the United States can't raise $400 easily, which is quite an astounding statistic. But we should also talk about some of the other institutional differences between the United States today and Germany in 1930. In 1933.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Bill Smaldone, who wrote the book Confronting Hitler and European Socialism, another one of his books. He teaches at Willamette. Bill, let's get into what you call the institutional differences between the United States and Germany in the 30s. I'd like to begin, though, with the threat to the people, the capacity for ruling elites to manufacture a crisis that would create this sort of vicious nationalism and a rearmament, and also set the police to suppressing dissent. They need a crisis for that. It seems to me the communists constituted a group that could be blamed for the crisis and that could be seen as a threat to Germany as a country and a people.
Well, I think that's correct. We have to bear in mind that the Weimar Republic, which the Nazis overthrew, was a republic that spent most of its existence, 14 years, in crisis. And one of the first crises to beset the republic was the threat of revolution in the post-war period from the radical left, because in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution, revolutions broke out in most of the Central European countries, and in most of the Central European countries, the social democratic left sort of rose to the top and was able to take power, but the communists to their left also constituted a revolutionary force. So you had great fear among a wide range of Germans of the communist threat. You also had great fear of industry and large-scale enterprise on the part of many Germans. You have to remember, Germany was also a society that still had a peasantry and still had a very large old middle class consisting of craftsmen, people who were being driven to the wall by modern industry. At that time, Germany was being modernized very fast. You had all kinds of new large-scale industries being established, and you had lots of department stores coming online and so on. And the Nazis were able to say to people, we will defend you against Bolshevik enemy on the left and the socialist enemy on the left and the unions and all of these Jewish-led organizations that are out to destroy Germany on the left. And on the right, we will defend you against the plutocracy, which is also led by Jews and which threatens your interest. We will defend you, the average German working man, the average small owner, the guy who just carries a hammer, right, or has a small shop. And they were very effective at delivering that message. So the Weimar Republic was a much different kettle of fish than the contemporary United States. The other thing we have to remember is that many of the institutions of the Republic were opposed to the new democracy that was founded after the war. The bureaucracy, the courts, they were all full of monarchists and authoritarian types who wanted some kind of authoritarian regime. Some of them wanted to bring back the Kaiser, the old emperor. Some of them wanted a kind of military regime. All of them wanted to strengthen the army, and all of them were interested in what Hitler basically said was making Germany great again, right? And so on the one hand, Hitler promised them to crush enemies on the left, and on the other hand, he promised to build the country up. So he had something to offer, both in terms of defending Germany against radicals, but also creating or recreating Germany as a powerful state. And that was the positive message.
It seems to me that nothing comparable to the kinds of threats that were both real and then manufactured by the Nazis. The Nazis saw the Jews as running both big industry and this modernization and and especially finance. In fact,
correct,
at least for most of industrialization, it was German capitalism was authentically German.
That's correct. Yeah. Although it should be said that the reason why many people could easily buy the falsehood that the Jews were taking over the economy and the Jews were undermining the German professions and society was that because the Jews who had been given equality in the late 19th century were also among the people who benefited most from a kind of democratization that was taking place in the society, and they entered the new professions, and they were very focused on education and so on, and they were, in terms of their proportion of the population, they were overrepresented in certain sectors, economic activity, and also in politics.
Yeah, so there was also the Rothschild Bank and various institutions
that could be. To find anecdotal evidence in support of their argument about the Jewish enemy. You should also remember that the Jews were presented as a kind of demon that could appear on the one side as a plutocratic capitalist and on the other side as the creator of Bolshevism. So they could be both the left and the right at the same time in the Nazi imagination.
Let's talk about now, compare that to today. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Bill Smaldon. We're talking about Could It Happen Here? The title of Sinclair Lewis's books about the possible rise of a fascist state in the United States on somewhat the model of Germany and Mussolini and Italy. Bill, totalitarianism, I think, could happen here. There could be deep economic crises here. And one of the problems, though, they would have is finding an enemy and finding a deep crisis and an external crisis of people trying to sort of take everything from Americans and destroy this country. And, for example, in Oklahoma, they passed a law forbidding the use of Sharia law. They think that Muslims are trying to impose Sharia law on the United States and have the power to do it, apparently. There's a lot of nuttiness out there, unfortunately. I mean, Oklahoma is not the United States, but some of those people are demoralized and looking for enemies and can be at least seduced into looking for those kind of enemies. But let's talk about some real crises. They're trying to gin up a number of crises, like Muslims, a dishonest press, misleading all of us. I mean, that's a serious sort of thing. And then there's, of course, Russia and China and the geopolitical situation, which it seems to me is getting more and more frightening as Trumpism begins. And they could really gin up a serious crisis, it seems to me.
Well, it's interesting because the question of the they is important, right? Because on the one hand, I have no doubt that a large portion of the Republican Party leadership and Donald Trump have no problem with ginning up fear against Islam, fear of Muslims, and they are willing to do that for their own political purposes. And Trump did that extremely effectively in his campaign, artificially producing this crisis, talking about Muslims pouring into the country when, of course, in fact, anybody coming from the countries that were on his recent ban, it takes them 18 to 24 months to get into this country. They are already heavily vetted, and what he wants to do is simply argue that the Obama administration was allowing them to come through like a sieve. And when his emergency decree was essentially blocked by the courts, he argued they were pouring into the country, which, of course, is a total falsehood. All of that is part of ginning up this widespread fear of terrorism that I think is easy to plant in some parts of our country where people are afraid of people who are not like them. So that's one side. On the other side, you have another they that is very keen on confrontation with Russia or with China. It doesn't seem like Trump himself is very interested in the confrontation with them, in fact, or at least with Russia. In fact, it's hard to tell exactly what's going on there. There's evidence, as we all know from the revelations of the past week, that it's possible the Trump campaign was in cahoots with the Russians in the effort to get Trump elected, which would, of course, to my mind, be a form of treason. So we don't really know where Trump is going with the Russian thing. But there are certainly many people in the government, in the Congress especially, who see Russia as a threat and who are interested in confrontation with Russia.
But the neocons in the Republican Party, it seems to me, are the force. They're really well connected, and they seem not to be able to get over the Cold War. It was there for many of them still. Antagonism to Russia and fears of Russia are a major part of their lives. They want to continue humiliating Russia. So, in fact, and they are trying. I mean, the Russians, of course, in the Ukraine is crucial to Russia, at least keeping them neutral, not even running it. And the U.S. was mobilizing to, in fact, add the Ukraine to NATO, and also Georgia, that state in one of the ex-Soviet states. They're encircling it, they're creating missile bases, and they're, of course, doing surveillance and flyovers and all kinds of provocative stuff, which is now also happening with regard to China and China's ambitions. It seems to me that those people are not going to stop. That is the neocons and Trump. He doesn't want to lose anything. Once he starts doing this stuff, he won't back down either. I mean, he's a bully, and his fragile ego will not allow him to lose. It seems to me that there's tremendous risk. On the other hand, Putin and the Chinese Communist Party that Putin forces is major kleptocracy on both sides, the Chinese as well as the Trump side. I mean, there are major kleptocracies who are fighting one another and don't want to lose, at least the leaders of them. It's frightening, actually, now.
It is. In my view, the dangerous thing is that if Trump is brought along to the position that he has to confront Russia or confront China, he will not be very skilled at doing that. He seems to think that this is all a big real estate deal. Well, in fact, when you have to face off against the Chinese Communist Party leadership, which is quite skilled in defending its interests, or when you have to face off against a leader like Vladimir Putin, who has his own personal as well as his group's interests to defend, it's going to be a very difficult road to hoe for Mr. Trump. I would like to say, though, that when you look at the relationship between the United States and Russia since the Cold War, you have to also go back to the early 1990s when the Americans backed Boris Yeltsin, who was essentially their boy in Russia, and they supported the creation of a political order there with a strong presidency in the early 1990s. And we are now paying the price for that, because once Yeltsin fell from power and was replaced by a much stronger figure, like Putin, this whole strategy backfired because Putin was no longer interested in basically towing the line for the United States and has attempted to reassert Russian power in Central Asia and in Eastern Europe. I don't think we have done much to placate Russian fears of NATO aggrandizement in Eastern Europe. At the same time, the Russians have violated all kinds of international norms and have been an aggressive power in places like Crimea and Ukraine. So it's like a tinderbox that could easily blow open. And having somebody in there as volatile as Trump is an incredible danger for the whole world.
I think we should get to China as well. Apparently, news, I guess, that I read this morning was that the U.S. is holding exercises in the South China Sea, where the Chinese are, with great difficulty and expense, taking some very small uninhabited islands and taking half the sand of the China Sea and or some great proportion of it to try and build these up into actual islands with military bases on them and small military bases. But they are challenging for sovereignty over this part of the world, pretty near China, but near a lot of other states, too. But they're throwing their weight around. And the U.S. has decided to show the flag. And now a number of U.S. destroyers and warships are sailing into that area that China claims. And China has warned the U.S. not to do it. seems to me those kinds of provocations, if Trump doesn't want to stand down, it could be not so much different than the Cuban Missile Crisis, except both Kennedy and Gorbachev were sane. And it took a long time before their sanity kicked in because neither wanted to lose.
Right.
And they finally made a deal. But there were nuclear weapons on cock, ready to go. It was a very dangerous thing. Well, you got Trump on top. And the Chinese communists, they have a fragile hold, really, on Chinese society. They're very clever and everything, but there are tremendous problems in China and resentment by large numbers of Chinese about lots of things.
Well, all three powers are using ginned-up nationalism for domestic purposes. And all three powers are attempting to assert their interests in far-flung parts of the world. So you have Russia operating closer to home in Eastern Europe, but also in Syria, right, and in elsewhere in Central Asia. You have China, right, which also has Central Asian interests and Southeast Asian interests, and it's attempting in recent years to build up a naval presence in the South China Sea, but also in the Indian Ocean.
Not to mention their investments in Africa and Latin America, which are now greater than U.S. investments.
Correct. We have a truly multipolar world now with three states, all in the hands of authoritarian leaders who ground their legitimacy in ginned-up nationalism, which creates a tremendously dangerous situation. And I agree with you. Donald Trump's personality, I don't know if he's actually deranged.
As crazy as he seems.
But he has not behaved in a way that gives one faith in his equanimity and rationality in dealing with a crisis.
Very well said. Very diplomatic, Bill. I think that's just about the end of the interview. Stay tuned for part three of this interview, which is the institutions of the United States. Are they strong enough to resist Trumpism? That is, the judiciary. What about the police? Finally, the forces of the left. Big issues. We'll get to those next week. Anyway, carry on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Bye-bye.
Right.